Our building will be reopening in 2 weeks, so for these last two Sundays before we reopen, I'm returning to Christian Essentials and talking about fellowship and then mission. We're going to read from Acts 2, where you find the first ever sermon by a follower of Jesus. It was the focus of a remarkable Pentecost festival in Jerusalem, and 3,000 people were apparently converted and baptized on the same day. Here's what it says in Acts 2, 40-47. Peter made his appeal to the people, and with many other words he urged them, saying, "Save yourselves from the punishment coming on this wicked people." Many of them believed his message and were baptized, and about 3,000 people were added to the group that day. They spent their time in learning from the apostles and in fellowship, breaking bread and praying together. Many miracles and wonders were being done through the apostles, and everyone was filled with awe. All the believers continued together in close fellowship and shared their belongings with one another. They would sell their property and possessions and distribute the money among all, according to what each one needed. Day after day they met as a group in the temple, and they had their meals together in their homes, eating with glad and humble hearts, praising God and enjoying the goodwill of all the people. And every day the Lord added to their group those who were being saved. When people talk about church these days, they tend to think about buildings. I go to such and such a church. The very words "I go to" show that our default is to think of places rather than people. When I was a kid, I went to a chapel. I remember talking to a bloke who went to a gospel hall, but I insisted that chapel was the correct name for a proper place of worship. The earliest Greek word for church, remember the earliest New Testament manuscripts were written in Greek, was ecclesia, and that literally means an assembly or congregation. In other words, it's about people, not stonework or fancy windows. An empty church building may have centuries of Christian devotion associated with it, and you may sense multiple layers of sacredness and tradition. But without people, and more specifically followers of Jesus, it's not a church. Now that's not new. You must have heard it said countless times. But language is important. I always smile when parents ask me to christen their children. Sometimes the language is a bit cruder and they say that they want to have their children done. But what do they think is happening? Do they think that this short ceremony is going to make their child a Christian? Do they think that the gift of eternal life hinges on a splash of water, or that a prayer of blessing has magical power? The words we use betray so much ignorance. And returning to church buildings, I don't need to tell you how much of a headache they can be. Some are listed with English heritage and as such aren't allowed to have double or triple glazed windows, so heat loss is a perpetual issue. Our building is locally listed, so we're not allowed to get rid of that tower. They call them follies because they serve no useful purpose. If you ask me, folly is the perfect word to use. Not many of the early buildings, which were built after the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine, have survived, and then later centuries introduced new styles like Gothic and Baroque. Look around and you'll find newer churches taking over more usable spaces, bus garages, bingo halls, pubs, even office blocks where the spare space is rented out to generate money for mission. But at the same time, the obsession with architecture persists. Apparently there's a 250-year-old windmill in Reigate Heath, which hasn't operated as a windmill for 160 years, is Grade 2 listed, and on the third Sunday of each summer month, it gets turned into a church and has a Christian act of worship. I'd love to see the seating arrangements. On the day of Pentecost, as recorded in our reading from Acts 2, the church was born. There was a temple in Jerusalem, and given that Christianity came out of Judaism, the first followers of Jesus continued to worship there. But as our video points out, they did far more. They started to give attention to the apostles' teaching, another way of saying Jesus' teaching, fellowship, prayer, and breaking bread together. Suddenly religion started happening outside the recently refurbished temple. And it had a practical edge to it, so that people shared their resources, the poor found assistance, the lame were healed, and needs were met. It may be dangerous to build too big an edifice on just one verse, but the core ingredients of church life were the explaining and implementing of Jesus' teaching, having fellowship, praying together and breaking bread. These were the early days, and no doubt breaking bread was part of a fellowship meal, but Luke clearly echoes those moments from his gospel when Jesus shared a Last Supper with his disciples and then broke bread with two others in the village of Emmaus. These days, churches have different ways of doing communion and they call it by different names, but clearly it was an important ingredient from the start. But what did Luke mean by fellowship? Was he talking about shaking hands during a service or having a chat over coffee and cake? Or did he have something richer and deeper in mind? One of the good things about worshipping over Zoom is that we've got to know each other's names better, for the simple reason that most of our names are attached to our boxes. The bit I really enjoy is when people are joining the meeting, and for 20 minutes, as the number increases, we share news and have a bit of banter. Zoom obviously has its limitations, but we are not identified by where we sit in a building anymore. But more seriously, there are two things that the New Testament writers make a lot of: hospitality and financial support. Now, when I was training 40 years ago, my theology tutor was putting the finishing touches to a book on fellowship entitled We Belong Together. And he flagged up both of these, hospitality and finance. You can probably think of examples yourself. Barnabas sold land he owned and gave the proceeds to the apostles to help meet the needs of the destitute. Paul started a collection for the Jerusalem Christians who had lived through a famine and were being discriminated against because they'd abandoned Judaism for Christianity. Lydia, a successful businesswoman in Philippi and a convert to the faith, insisted that Paul and his companions stay at her property rent-free. These were expressions of fellowship. Paul pictured the church as a body. If the knee wasn't functioning, the rest of the body would adapt and ease the pressure on it. He wrote that amazing chapter on love, sandwiched between all the body stuff in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14, which, contrary to popular opinion, is therefore not about marriage primarily, but about life in the church. And fellowship was to be about more than just supporting. It was about encouraging those feeling inadequate and correcting those who were living disobedient lives. Baptists appeared in England just over 400 years ago. For quite a long time, they were a persecuted minority, but then gradually this country became more tolerant. What's interesting is that during those early years, church meeting minutes reveal that they were far more focused on the purity of the congregation and the ways its members were behaving in society. Then later, as we began to build places of worship, there was a shift in emphasis from fellowship and discipleship to attendance on Sundays and maintenance of buildings. Religious freedom was embraced wholeheartedly, but perhaps in the process we lost our edge. Our focus shifted from quality to quantity, from congregation to aggregation. I'm probably oversimplifying. 200 years ago, there was an Anglican church in Camberwell, where Lois and I used to live, which deployed 200 volunteers every week to attend to the needs of the poor in their district. This was long before the welfare state and the state pension, long before council housing and social workers. Destitution meant destitution in 19th century England. These days, I get people asking me for help. We've got a 2-year phone contract costing them £40 a month. And then they don't have enough left to buy food. And will I help? I have to say, I tend to suffer with compassion fatigue sometimes. Jesus said, "People will know you are my followers when you show love for one another." This was important for the first Christians, as it still is for many today. For deciding to follow Jesus alienates many people from their families and sometimes even puts their lives at risk. We have a saying, blood is thicker than water, by which we mean that family ties are stronger than other ties. But this is not true for Christians coming from cultures or families where other faiths dominate. For such people, it can be true that water is thicker than blood. For the waters of Christian baptism promise a level of fellowship and support that won't come from their families and may not be found in wider society. I was reading the moving story of Jim Christiansen, a man whose life was broken, but with the help of Jesus and his people, it was put back together. His story was not untypical. A mother who would constantly put him down. Teenage years dominated by a growing drug addiction. A marriage which quickly began to fail as he moved from cocaine to crack cocaine. The loss of his job, stealing from his wife to feed his habit, and then a heart attack. His family pleaded with him to get help and took him to a Salvation Army rehab unit, but he walked away and for 3 days wandered the streets, his life in tatters. He stayed dry long enough to get into the rehab unit, and then one night he picked up a Bible and a voice said to him, "Follow me and I will renew your life." It was a turning point. He completed the rehab and joined the Salvation Army Church, where he got the help he needed. Eventually, he returned to his family, secured a job in the pizza business, and won back the trust of his wife and children. 10 years on, and he has no regrets. This is the real business of church, working with Jesus to enrich each other's lives, mending what's broken, offering hope, being the community of love and grace which mirrors his life. There's a nice story in the New Testament. Saul of Tarsus, arch adversary and persecutor of the church, had a life-changing encounter with Jesus as he was travelling to Damascus. It left him blinded for several days. The Christians in Damascus had already heard he was coming and were understandably anxious. But then one of them, Ananias, had a vision in which the Lord told him to go and restore Saul's sight. We don't know whether Ananias hesitated, but he went. And when he found Saul, he said these words, "Brother Saul," and he prayed for him to receive his sight and the Holy Spirit. We never hear of this Ananias again, but that one word, "brother," endures. What if he'd refused to go? What if those early disciples had all kept their heads down? What if Jesus had refused to come to the earth? What if we Christians cling so tightly to our buildings that we never really get our hands dirty? Jesus talked about sheep and goats and reminded us that what we do for those in need is what we do for him. So two final quotes for you. Rick Warren, "Fellowship is a place of grace where mistakes aren't rubbed in but rubbed out. Fellowship happens when mercy wins over justice." And then the extraordinary Dietrich Bonhoeffer, "It is the fellowship of the cross to experience the burden of others. If you do not experience it, the fellowship you belong to is not Christian. If any member refuses to bear that burden, they deny the law of Christ." So, may we all embrace that law of love.